Welcome to
What's News?
With me, Nikita.
And me, Saskia.
This is a podcast that attempts to unpick the recent goings-on in all things British politics. We're going to look at key policy announcements, personnel changes, and all the chaos in between. So, Saskia, what have you been up to this week?
So, quite sadly, I started off the week ill.
Yeah.
Although that was last week, to be fair. So, first part of last week was just sleeping, I'd say. Then we did recover, and I actually had quite a fun week. Nice. Went to fight night.
You know, you did? Yeah. I didn't get tickets in the end. How was it?
It was really good.
Oh, nice.
I quite like it because you don't even really know who these people are. You just kind of decide. You're like, I like their walkout song, so I'm going to cheer them on. So it was actually a really nice week. Very excited for term to end.
Yeah.
But yeah, what about you? What were you up to?
Nothing much, really.
Just surviving uni,
I was seeing people, meeting people. Nice. We all feel like the term coming to an end and knowing that after Easter, meeting up with people isn't going to be the same.
No.
And it's a lot's going to change. So we're trying to meet people on campus and do things that we normally do. I'm going to AU Ball tomorrow, the Athletics Union Ball.
Oh my God, exciting.
Yeah, it is in Fulham though, which is an absolute trek. It's very far. So yeah, I guess we'll see.
That's how that good goes.
I'm sure we'll be.
So yeah, good luck. Let me know how it goes.
I'll send you updates.
Yeah. Nice.
But yeah, let's try and link this chat tenuously onto the last 2 weeks of holidays.
Budgets. AU Ball budgets is what we can talk about.
Yes. So 5 days ago, I think, 5-6 days ago, Jeremy Hunt released and announced his budget to Parliament. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of key policies within that that we wanted to discuss. I think we're going to focus on 4 main things that he mentioned ideas.
Yeah.
Do you want to cover some of them?
Yeah. So I'd like to begin this with, this is not a comprehensive overview of what happened in the budget.
Yeah.
There's a lot out there. But I thought these were just some interesting parts that we could have a chat about. I think the first one was mainly saying Hunt was very clear on his economic forecast. He said, guys, it's not going to be as bad as we thought it would be.
Yeah.
Good times are coming. We shouldn't be going to a recession. That was quite a positive start. And on the subject of cost of living support, Hunt confirmed that the energy price guarantee will remain at £2,500 until July. It was meant to rise to £3,000 originally, and there was quite a lot of campaigning from key figures like Martin Lewis.
We love him.
He was tweeting a lot about it. Just to make sure that, you know, people are still using their heating.
Yeah.
Just for us to get through, you know, the next few months, and hopefully by July, we won't need it as much.
Mm-hmm.
Childcare was quite a big feature of the budget. There's been a lot of talk recently about how expensive childcare is. A lot of people are very unhappy about it and, you know, justifiably struggling with it. And Hunt announced quite a big policy. I would say, you know, this is big spending. You know, this is really going to impact people. And he said parents of children aged 9 months to 3 years will be offered 30 hours a week of free childcare in term time, as long as both parents are working at least 16 hours a week. Now, what is interesting is that there's a cap on earnings in terms of whether or not you receive that support.
Okay.
So when I looked on the government's website on the subject of the budget, they said the parents who work more than 16 hours a week, like I said earlier, and they earn less than £100,000. Obviously, £100,000 is quite a lot. But what I'm not talking about the amount here.
Yeah.
I'm talking more about the threshold of which.
And the idea that it's just like one point at which after that you don't get anything.
So it can lead to incentivizing, you know, people changing their incomes to try and receive the support. So it'd be interesting to see how that unfolds. If that actually occurs, maybe it won't. But that's something to think about when actually policies get implemented. In terms of thinking about the older people in British society, pensions was also a massive thing. So there used to be a cap on the amount workers can accumulate in their pension savings over their lifetime before having to pay extra tax. In the budget, we found out that this is going to be abolished. Now, this was mainly in response to a lot of NHS doctors who would retire earlier than, say, the average person, because they'd accumulated this amount of money. And in order for them to work more, they would have faced this extra tax, and that just doesn't provide an incentive to work more. And obviously the NHS is not going through a good time right now. So this was the Conservative government's attempt to try and, you know, bring these people back into work.
Just as a heads up, they were already bringing these people back into work because they didn't have staff. But now this is a way of them getting them back into work, not just out of their own goodwill, but actually like a monetary incentive.
I think they were like, we might need to do a bit more here, which understandably. So, but what's what's worth noting with this, at least, is the fact that this applies to everyone, mm-hmm. rather than just NHS doctors. But that's also something to think about in terms of things like inheritance tax, mm-hmm. and what the tax systems are like with pensions.
Mm-hmm.
So whether or not people will try and use these pensions as a way of, if they want to give money to their kids when they die, etc.,
mm-hmm.
Will they try and use that as a way to pay less tax?
Mm.
Like I said, when we see policies in the budget,
mm-hmm.
we don't know what their implementation will look like.
Yeah.
I'm just saying these things is like, it's worth noting that this might be a concern that the government's probably thought about. So mm-hmm. they might have ways of trying to combat this
mm-hmm.
when it comes to implementation. But yeah, those were my kind of like, oh, the big things, the interesting things of the budget. There was a lot more. And yes, the BBC definitely provides a lot of insight into
yes all
that.
It definitely does. So definitely, if you want to know more about how the budget affects you financially, there are lots of good explanation sites, as we already mentioned, Martin Lewis, the BBC, and obviously mainstream media in general has done good breakdowns. And there's obviously a lot of questions that arise from the budget as well. We don't really have time to cover all of the different avenues that we can consider the budget, but one big thing that's affected the cost of living a lot over the last year and a half has been energy prices. And so the consideration of how lower energy prices are going to affect growth and household incomes this year is obviously a big question that comes into play, because the new forecast from the Office for Budget Responsibility was sort of conditioned on much lower forecasts for interest rates and energy prices. And so the idea that sort of their forecast didn't really come to fruition in the same way that they expected really like begs the question of how this budget's going to impact energy prices, and also how energy prices are going to kind of consequently impact how the budget then gets implemented.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have answers for these questions, but they're good things to consider generally. Also, another question is generally about like the Office for Budget Responsibility's pessimism or optimism in the way that it considers the UK's economy. It kind of starts to, I think one of my politics professors actually talked to us about this. He explained that in politics degrees and political science, you'd know this as well, when we write essays, we often say, this is good, this is bad, it weighs up like this, but overall, this is slightly better than this, but it's kind of mixed. It's always a mixed picture.
Yeah,
we can never say anything for definite.
Mm.
Yet economic forecasts say things really strongly and forcefully, as though they know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
But more often than not, economists get these predictions wrong in a way that political scientists don't actually, in that they normally have much more basis in terms of process and mechanism for the history of a policy and how that will then be implemented and affected, in a way that markets don't really have that certainty.
Yeah.
And I just think it's interesting with bodies like the OBR and Bank of England having to
weigh up
all of these issues. It's a very hard job, and I'm not saying that they are doing it badly, but it's quite hard for them to get it right.
Yeah.
And that's just another interesting thing that comes out of this budget, I think. Yeah, so that was the budget overall. And also, we just wanted to cover some other quick points that kind of lead on from some of the stuff we discussed in the last episode. The first one being the Windsor framework, which we explained in detail last time, which was a framework that's trying to fix the post-Brexit problems in Northern Ireland. 2 weeks ago, we mentioned that the Democratic Unionist Party, which is the DUP, is boycotting Northern Ireland's devolved government at Stormont until its concerns about trading arrangements have been addressed. Obviously, Rishi's plan and his sort of development of the framework was to address these problems so that Stormont can get back up and running. But they announced, I think it was 2 days ago, that they are not going to support the deal. And this is a big issue, because even if Rishi can pass the agreement in Parliament, his main idea was to have some sort of unity in Northern Ireland on the issue, and he hasn't got it. So it doesn't really matter if the deal gets passed, because there's still going to be opposition from one of the key members that needed to be convinced by this policy.
Yeah.
We just wanted to also cover the illegal migration bill, which also was discussed and overlooked over the past week or so. Mm-hmm. So do you want to cover a little bit more about what that was about?
Yes. So the illegal migration bill was the Conservatives government's attempt to deal with the issue of small boat crossings in the Channel.
Mm-hmm.
Suella Braverman announced that migrants entering the UK illegally on small boats will be detained and swiftly removed under new legislation. and they will also be blocked from returning. Within this, there's also going to be a cap on the numbers granted asylum. Now, this was quite a big policy. There's been a lot of reception towards it. We're going to go into the specifics of one example of this form of reception shortly. But I think Rishi, in his speech in January, said that dealing with illegal migration was one of his top five priorities. So we could kind of sense that there was going to be some form of legislation that was coming, because even in the chamber, and there was these leaked WhatsApp messages about a lot of backbench Conservative MPs saying, where's the legislation to stop the boat? So there was a lot of pressure on Rishi Sunak to come up with this legislation. And this is what we've seen with the illegal migration bill. Another thing to consider is, people were like, okay, so if you're going to remove them, where are they going? So this is going to happen by sending them either to Rwanda or a safe third country.
Which they argue Rwanda is also a safe third country. So that's like their, that's their flagship headline example. And they're going to obviously try and add to that to create, I don't know, some sort of library of safe third countries.
So it's... we don't know what's going to happen with it. It's passed, I think, first and second reading in the Commons. But what most of the reception will be like will be legal challenges that will come later on, which is what we saw with Rwanda. So it's not necessarily what happens in the Commons, but actually what happens away from it, which will threaten its existence more than, say, MPs complaining about it.
And also human rights organisations are very good at doing legal challenges. Like, if anyone's going to put up a proper opposition in a court, it's, they couldn't fly any of the planes last time because each refugee was just like, no, I've got rights, I I court cases, I appeal, and slowly they couldn't fly, they couldn't take off. So
it's been, there's been quite a lot of response to it. Something to consider is this wider issue of, you know, asylum seekers and how can they come here legally. So
the safe and legal routes, like, you have to make one for that to happen.
So the government have said in response to this that they've said, well, we had the Ukrainian scheme, you had the Arab scheme, which was for Afghan refugees, and I think there's also a Hong Kong scheme. Now, the only issue with that is that's only three countries. So this means that there needs to be quite a lot more consideration onto what these safe and legal routes can be.
And it also, this kind of links to something that I'm discussing in my dissertation about global Britain and what it means in terms of national role identity. But I talk about the Hong Kong agreement, and I also talk about sort of the view of Ukraine and how people have accepted refugees from Ukraine, and something about the synergy between Ukraine as a European country, as a white European country, and the connection that the UK has with that element of its identity, and the connection with Hong Kong as somewhere that wants to protect liberal democracy and is a former colonial connection. So there's these sort of three circles of British interests in terms of, like, the Commonwealth and the Empire, Europe and European values, and then obviously, like, America and English-speaking countries. And those three spheres often align in terms of how Britain views other people and what's important to it. So if something in terms of, like, asylum seeking or refugees doesn't fit that, and they are coming through different countries and ending up in Calais, Britain thinks, where's, what's in it for me? And that does sort of affect its foreign policy in a lot of ways, and you can see that quite clearly with its refugee policy in this instance. So it really does connect. So
interesting. Like, even on the perspective of, like, global kind of unique global cooperation and that idea, I think there has been, Rishi Sunak went to France to see Macron.
That was very, like, bromance, wasn't it?
Yeah, I even, I think I saw, like, quite sophisticated journalists use the word bromance, and I was like, oh, guys, we're not doing that. But anyway, that's kind of the idea that in order to have a policy where we don't have many safe and legal routes, we do have some, but we don't have tons, for example, it does require other countries to want to work with us. So that's something you have to consider, because I think it was a select committee that I saw this video where essentially someone was like, well, if the UK does this, then can't it create a domino effect of multiple countries not wanting to take in asylum seekers? So that's something you need to consider in the future. And like I say, with most of these things, it's hard to know what it will be like in 3 years' time with this policy or in 1 year's time. Like, it's it's hard to tell when there could be legal challenges. How do other countries respond? France actually responded quite well, I'd say, is we are giving them money to deal with that, but then we can't do that to every country. It's just more the relationship between the UK and France in terms of the channel.
Yeah.
It makes more logical sense in order to provide some financial incentive to want France to work with us. But it's a complicated policy. There's been a big response. The response we want to talk about is from a man called Gary Lineker.
Yes.
The Match of the Day presenter, the Walker's Crisp man.
Former footballer for...
Yeah, literally forget that he's a footballer sometimes.
What did he... Who did he play for? He was very, very, very successful football player, but I don't know what team for, sorry.
Oh, he played for Everton.
Everton.
And Barcelona. Okay, well, we're not discussing how good a footballer he was, but he's a very well-known man, is what I was trying to say.
Yes.
But yes, so Gary Lineker got involved in all of this.
And he is known for being a prolific tweeter about his own opinions. Yeah. He really uses his own Twitter platform to say what he thinks. A lot of that time is spent on politics, to be honest.
Yeah.
And generally, we could say that he's quite centre-left. Generally. Yeah, he's not, like, pro-Labour. He's just quite centre-left.
It'd be different if he was like, oh, I love Keir, everyone go vote for Keir. Yeah. That would be an issue.
Yeah, he just says what he thinks about whatever's happening during politics and political environment. So what did he say about this?
So, Gary Lineker, and I'm going to use the actual quote, I'm going to quote his tweet, because there's been a lot of manipulation about what he said, and we'll talk about that. But Gary Lineker tweeted in response to Suella Braverman, what she was saying about the illegal migration bill. Gary said, "This is just an immeasurably cruel policy directed at the most vulnerable in language that is not dissimilar to that used by Germany in the 30s. So that was the tweet. And boy... did that create a lot of drama?
It blew up. Like, honestly, it only happened over 4 days, but it felt like it was its own TV series.
Honestly.
W1A-esque, if there are any fans out there. But it was incredible.
No. Like, normally, I kind of measure things by whether or not my brother speaks to me, like, about these.
Yeah,
and
obviously, has it cut through?
Yeah. And, like, and Ian Rice pulled out. I was like, wow, this has really reached the average voter here. But anyway, we'll go into it a bit more before we go into the rest of the drama. But, okay, so that was the tweet.
Yes.
It's really important in this context to know that the BBC is meant to be impartial. And there was automatically a big response saying, you know, oh, how can Gary say this if he works for the BBC, da, da, da. And then quite a lot of people responded saying, well, he's a sports presenter, he's not a news presenter. If he was doing this on the 6 o'clock news, that would be a serious problem. But he was using his personal Twitter account, and it's really important to note that he's freelance.
Yes.
He gets, you know, he gets his amount, and he gets a lot from the BBC.
Yes, he's the highest paid presenter. I think it's in... they're multi-millions.
Yes.
And then after that, it's the Strictly presenters. So you can see, like, their most popular programmes are their most, like, highest paid presenters, and Gary Lineker's obviously
the most,
because a lot of people watch Match of the Day.
Yeah.
Like you mentioned earlier, if you're not watching the football or you haven't caught up, but you're generally a football fan, it's the show to go to just get your full rundown.
Yeah, just to explain what Match of the Day is, I know that's not the point of the podcast, but I think a lot of people, if you don't watch it, you'd be like, "What? Who cares about this Gary guy?" Like, the Match of the Day is on Saturday night after the news. And it goes through all the highlights of today, the day's Premier League matches. And you have Gary Lineker, you have Ian Wright, you have Alan Shearer, you have some quite big former footballers who just offer their two cents about, oh, this, who was good in the match, oh, that's a problem for the future. Now, that doesn't sound remarkable, but it really is done well. And also the Match of the Day theme song is amazing.
It's about
it is a really watched programme, is what I'm trying to say. And, you know, for a lot of the British public, football is quite a big deal for them.
Yeah.
So if you mess with their football, people have emotions.
Yeah, and so what, like, after this sort of fallout happened with his tweet, all different Conservative MPs, including Rishi Sunak, weighed in, saying he can't say this, this is unacceptable.
Yeah.
Tim Davey, who is the Director General of the BBC, was in America at the time, people were ambushing him outside hotel lobby, saying, what's your opinion, what do you think? And then he revealed that, yes, this is not in line with impartiality rules. We will be talking to Gary Lineker to discuss this with him. And until then, he won't be presenting Match of the Day.
Yes.
And at first, Gary said, after an up and down, I will be presenting Match of the Day. Later that day, he said there was a BBC News alert, actually.
Yeah.
He's not presenting Match of the Day.
Yeah.
And so he wasn't going to be presenting it. And then everyone's just thinking, who's going to present it instead? And then what happened?
And then it was quite, honestly.
It was like dominoes. It was great.
I was just on Twitter watching this all unfold.
Yeah.
So normally Gary has his co-pundits, or he has people that are on, say, if he's not on. You know, there's quite a lot of people that can fill his shoes.
Yeah, it's rotating, isn't it?
So all of a sudden, we see each of these people come out and tweet, in solidarity with Gary,
yeah,
I am not going to present Match of the Day tomorrow.
Yeah.
And we saw really big names, like I said earlier. Yeah. Alan Shearer, massive footballer back in the day. Mm-hmm. You know, once again, if you know football, you know him. Ian Wright, he was on I'm a Celeb, you know. They're kind of like celebrities in
and
their
then
own right.
Beyond that, so then we realised Match of the Day was going to be some sort of highlights package because
yes,
they didn't have anyone
yes
to contribute.
Yeah.
Then the next day they have another show, Football Focus.
Yeah.
All the presenters pulled out of that.
Yeah.
Then the radio show for Sunday afternoon,
yeah,
Radio
Goodbye
5 Live. Everyone was saying we're not going to present it. There were even shows that I hadn't heard of that I don't think other people had heard of. It almost bought them clout, them
yeah
saying I'm also not going to present
yeah
my show.
I'm like, okay. Thanks for letting us know.
No. Yeah.
But, you know.
But honestly, I think we could say quite comfortably that Saturday and Sunday, there was not any BBC Sport coverage other than the news sports coverage.
Yeah.
There was
just
no
highlights.
Yes.
Like, no like, even when I didn't watch it at the time because I kind of didn't want to watch it, but because I was like, oh, no. I want to see. But I saw it on Gogglebox later. And they didn't even have commentary on the matches.
It was literally just YouTube videos.
It was quite incredible. It's just basically having it on mute. Like,
yeah,
there was no difference to it.
Yeah.
And it was, yeah, it was significantly reduced coverage. Although, what is worth noting, and Nadine Doris did note this, is that it actually had the highest amount of viewers.
That's funny, because everyone wanted to
yeah
see
what
it
was
like. Yeah,
because it's like, we want to see what the drama is.
Yeah,
that's
so funny.
Yeah, Nadine Doris weighed in on the issue. But yeah, so no real Match of the Day occurred.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was quite a big disruption.
Yes.
And that's Tim Daly then steps in on Monday and
mm-hmm
says, you know, I'm sorry for the disruption to the football.
Mm-hmm.
Him and Gary had a chat.
Yeah.
And they said, okay, Gary, we want you to come back and we're going to have a review into our guidelines.
Yeah, so there was not any immediate punishment, as we can see, and I don't think there can be because of how much backlash it caused.
Yeah.
From both sides, just too many people were talking about
everyone
it.
Everyone was talking about it.
And I think probably anything they do now will be a bit more private. They'll probably just tell him a bit more strictly, maybe.
Yeah.
Or they'll review their guidelines to
and
make
so
it a bit more logical
yeah
in terms of, because it's not even that impartiality isn't important, it's just really difficult to achieve, and the BBC wants it to.
Yeah.
Because another thing that we've noted was other presenters on the BBC who work in a similar capacity to Gary Lineker haven't been disciplined in the same way for their comments on media, such as Alan Sugar for The Apprentice. For those of you that don't know what The Apprentice is, it's a reality TV show that's for business, I don't even want to say it's business. It's loosely based on business.
Yeah. It's people that think they want to be in business.
Yes.
Is the idea.
And so there's sort of 12 normally wannabe influencers now. It
yeah
used to be more like characterful
yeah
people.
Yeah.
And they want to go 50-50 into business with Lord Alan Sugar,
who
is
a businessman.
Man,
yeah.
It was Amstrad Computers.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah, yeah.
And so they want to go into business with him. They'll get an investment from him, and they have to prove themselves over weeks doing
yeah
different business-based challenges.
Yeah.
Again, loosely business-based.
Yeah, yeah.
And Alan Sugar is super critical of Jeremy Corbyn and Jeremy Corbyn's leadership of the Labour
yeah
Party when he was leader. And he also doesn't like Keir Starmer much. So
yeah
one of his advisors in the programme is Karen Brady.
Baroness
Brady, actually. If you watched Apprentice this week, that reference would make sense.
Oh
to
my
you
god.
It was
funny.
It made me
it
laugh.
Everyone.
It made me laugh. But yes, Baroness Brady to us. She's Karen to her friends.
Yeah.
She is a Conservative Party donor. And she obviously became Baroness after appointment from a Conservative Party Prime Minister. So there's a lot of... I guess she doesn't talk as explicitly about her political views. We just know that she's a donor. But with Alan Sugar, literally every other day he'd be tweeting, I hate Jeremy Corbyn, I hate this.
No, don't vote for him. Like, it was quite persistent, really. Yes. It wasn't a one-off. And I'm not saying, because Gary's tweeted in the past, so I can't be like, oh, it was one-off for Gary.
Yeah.
But Alan really goes at it, to be honest. Yeah. So... And he's still here.
Yeah. And then moving beyond just other BBC presenters, let's talk about, like, the BBC management itself. Tim Davey was the chair of the Hammersmith and Fulham.
Yeah, chair or deputy.
And that's the Conservative Council. So he is a Conservative. Like, he's a Conservative Party member, I'm assuming, still. I don't think he'd need to give that up to become Director General. And also, what is Richard Sharp's actual position? Is he chairman?
He's chairman.
So Richard Sharp got appointed as chairman, which is a political appointment, I think maybe 2 years ago, when Boris Johnson was still Prime Minister. And then we recently found out that he facilitated a loan. I don't actually know the loan business. He put the people in touch.
Yes.
Boris Johnson and...
Helping Boris Johnson secure an £800,000 loan.
Right, okay. So we could say facilitated. He didn't fund the loan.
No.
But the loan only happened because of him. And so... We can again see an issue here in terms of impartiality, about the lens of impartiality. You can't be fully impartial if you have a sort of approach to impartiality that picks on one and doesn't pick on the other. Yeah. And also if your own perspective of that is coming from a point of explicit political party interaction. It's difficult. And I'm not saying that you... can't have party affiliation and also be impartial in the way of your work. But it just becomes much easier to criticize you when you get something wrong. And I think that's what's happened a lot here, especially from the left. Keir Starmer and the Labour Party really went in Prime Minister's questions that week about how that whole Gary Lineker situation played out, because it's so easy to criticise the actions of an impartial organisation when the management is conservative and the sort of punishments are happening to anti-conservative voices. So it's really easy to just build all of that criticism together. So it's a difficult situation overall.
Yeah, and I think this has kind of always been going on. Like, the issue of impartiality in the BBC isn't new. It just kind of, there'll be one big thing and it comes up all over again. And it's just this constant battle of, like, how do you achieve impartiality? You know, is the aim of just kind of annoying everyone, therefore you're doing your job? So, honestly, I wouldn't want their job. Like, trying to work out that one, and, you know, I think they needed to do a review on their social media guidelines, especially if, A, you're a freelancer, or B, you're not presenting something that is actually linked to the news. This obviously needs to be worked out, because this is not going to be the last time that this happens if they don't change something. But boy, did it really dominate headlines.
Yes, it really did. And also, it felt like it was such a long period of time during the time, but then also it moved so quickly that when we were preparing for this week's, we didn't even realise that it all happened in between.
Yeah.
It feels like so long ago somehow. But yeah, it really took up a lot of oxygen that weekend. For sure. And something else that's probably going to take up a lot of oxygen over the next few days is this whole defence dossier business with Boris Johnson, which, again, is something leading on from last week. For context, Boris Johnson may have misled Parliament on four occasions over Party A. And Party A, we talk about this pretty much every week, so hopefully you won't need a reminder anymore, but Party A was this whole series of events during the beginning of Boris Johnson's premiership over the lockdown, at which point we were all following certain COVID rules, and later on in his premiership we found out that it wasn't necessarily happening in Downing Street in the same way. And as people asked questions in Parliament, he would give certain answers. Later they would be shown to not be true, and we didn't know if Boris Johnson was lying intentionally to Parliament or if he was just completely unaware. So that's basically what this overall inquiry is about. So today he's expanded on that claim, saying that he's never knowingly misled Parliament, and he's expanded on the claim with a 52-page defence, which is a lot of pages.
A lot of pages.
A lot of pages. And he's going to be grilled by MPs on Wednesday in the Privileges Committee. And the Privileges Committee, I might have said previously that it was chaired by Chris Bryant, but we need to clarify that Chris Bryant isn't actually chairing this particular inquiry because he said that he's had particular perspectives and opinions, which he definitely has, about this issue. So Harriet Harman is actually chairing the committee, and the committee has a Tory majority because, as we mentioned, it's in line with how the Parliament's majority works. So, so do you want to expand on what he's actually said in the actual defence document?
I'd love to. Because I feel like sometimes I kind of forget about the days of Boris Johnson.
Yeah.
And then days like this bring me back. So, I think I'm just going to start with what I think is the best part, and we were talking about this before the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
So, in this defence dossier, Boris Johnson claimed the committee had not found evidence he intentionally misled MPs.
Mm-hmm.
He said the only exception were assertions made by his top aide, Dominic Cummings.
Barnard Castle, Cummings, testing his eyesight one.
Whom he said was discredited and was motivated by personal animosity. Miss Dominic Cummings loves a tweet, so he was straight on Twitter after reading this.
Mm-hmm.
He said that a drinks party in the number 10 garden attended by Mr. Johnson had been deemed to have broken the rules by police, with officials fined for attending.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually saw this tweet earlier today, and he was kind of speaking about junior staff were fined for this party, but actually Boris Johnson wasn't, because Boris Johnson was fined for a different thing.
I remember this.
So that was, I think, trying to go down the route of attacking Dominic Cummings, who was very pivotal in Brexit, the EU referendum, getting Boris Johnson elected to number 10, and advising Boris Johnson until Dominic Cummings is...
Also, another big thing that people forget, the only reason why Rishi Sunak is Prime Minister now is because he got his name as Chancellor. He only became Chancellor because Dominic Cummings got Boris Johnson to get rid of Sajid Javid when Sajid Javid didn't want to fire his whole team to take on these new advisors that Dominic Cummings has picked. Sajid Javid said, no, I'm not doing it. He left. And Rishi Sunak was immediately like, yeah, I'll take your advice. I'll be Chancellor. Yeah. Come on, let's do it. So,
oh my God, I can't believe you forgot
about
that.
I know. I remembered it the other day and I thought Rishi Sunak's career is built on the moves of Dominic Cummings as well.
He's a powerful man that knows quite a lot about these characters.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Johnson said, I've not misled MBs, apart from this one bit of evidence that I'm just not going to count because this man I don't like said it. So... That's kind of the big part. He said quite a lot. He went through the events that might be possibly bad for him in each part of the document and said why he hadn't done anything wrong.
Mm-hmm.
It was quite a lengthy document, like we said.
Yeah.
And tomorrow the hearing begins and...
We're both very excited.
Who knows what's going to unfold.
We'll have it on... So there's going to be Prime Minister's questions.
Yeah.
There's going to be...
In Northern Ireland.
The Northern Ireland. And there's going to be this. So a busy day.
In Parliament.
Parliament TV live. That's going to be a lot of traffic on that website.
Yeah. Do you want to go into possible outcomes?
Yes, I can do. Another thing that Boris Johnson has done during his defence dossier is attack the actual conduct of the inquiry, because he's accused the committee of being highly partisan and going against precedents that other inquiries have set. The committee has decided generally that whether he intended to mislead Parliament and the MPs in Parliament is not really relevant to what he's been charged with investigating, and it's actually whether it was stopped from doing his job by his statements to MPs. So it's the overall idea of, it's not really necessarily of whether he was misleading people, it was the effect that the misleading was having on general policy making and the overall conduct of Parliament, and also his own government's conduct. Like, they were sort of waiting for him to have to defend every single allegation left, right, centre, rather than focusing on COVID recovery and everything. So, yes, that seems to be one of the major differences of opinion in terms of Boris Johnson's attack of conduct of the actual committee, and the committee returning saying, well, it doesn't really matter what our conduct is because the facts are the facts and we're just analysing them to see the effect of them. Another thing is the idea that he might have misled Parliament recklessly rather than sort of... I think this is clutching at straws in terms of language, but I do get the point. Rather than with malicious intent, he was just so careless in his conduct that it was misleading. But I think ultimately, if you mislead, you mislead. And
yeah, I feel like the way, I feel like they've come up with that to be like, okay, how could Boris Johnson get out of this? Mm-hmm. And what could be our counter response?
Mm-hmm.
Because he's very clearly said, well, I didn't mislead Parliament intentionally.
Yeah.
Because he's really focusing on, like you said, that, you know, malicious intent.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they're trying to act like, well, he was a careless prime minister.
Yeah.
But I don't think he's going to, he said he doesn't like that idea anyway.
It's, and the only thing that changes is the length of the sanction.
Yeah.
So it's literally the length of his suspension, if he does get a suspension. I think, I don't know about sort of other analysts' opinions on this, but I'm going off the opinion that he will be suspended to some length of time because it does seem like they have very strong evidence, which is why he's had to put this defence document together, because if it was quite comfortable for him, he wouldn't be attacking things like conduct, because he could attack the facts. If he's attacking things like conduct, it's like, I want to discredit the actual inquiry because they've probably got a good conclusion. Yeah.
The only thing that could threaten, you know, the like committee's hearing and like what they actually find is the fact that the full House has to vote on it.
Oh, but then again, a lot of Conservative MPs resigned on account of Boris Johnson.
Yeah.
And if they say reckless, a lot of Conservative MPs will say, we know that you didn't mean it, but you were careless and you were reckless. Let's just move on from this now. Have a 3-day suspension and then come back.
The only thing I'm thinking is, like, a lot of people will look at where the Conservatives are in the polls, particularly MPs, and be like,
we shouldn't do that.
Back in the day when we had Boris Johnson, the polls weren't really that bad.
That's very true.
But what's worth noting is they're allowed to vote however they want to vote. In this, Rishi said, vote how you want. Yes. You're not getting punished for how you vote.
Mm.
So that'll be interesting to see whether or not people go down, you know, rose-tinted glasses back in the day, we were doing well in the polls.
Yeah.
Or actually, yeah, he was careless.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we need to move on. This thing keeps on getting brought up.
Mm.
If Rishi Sunak can focus on his policies, the budget. Yeah. Because whilst this is happening, the government's actual policies are kind of losing their actual focus in the news.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I think that might be something that Conservative MPs weigh up in their minds. But
yeah, and also I forgot to say, in terms of range of punishments, there's obviously suspension and length of suspensions from Parliament, but also it could just be a formal apology, which I think would be quite funny considering the circumstances. if after all this, it's just to sort of stand up at the box and be like, I'm really sorry about all of that. Sorry, guys. And then sit down again. Like, after the whole inquiry, after all the evidence, 52-page document, they say, can you just say sorry, please? I'm not sure if that will be the outcome, but equally, let's not preempt it, because he could have a really good in-person defence tomorrow and things could develop in a really different way. So let's hold hang fire for now.
Yeah.
But yeah, if he was suspended for more than 10 days, this could trigger a by-election in his constituency, which is Uxbridge and Ruislip.
Yeah.
And that is not a really comfortable majority for the Conservative Party by any means. It's not a swing seat, but it's definitely not comfortable. I think
especially now.
Yes. And I also, yeah, in terms of by-elections, they seem to be really, like, Lib Dem-y at the moment. Like, if the Liberal Democrats want to win and use their sort of ninja tactics to win it, they do really well.
Yeah.
And also, Labour came very close second during the actual general election. Yeah, because
they picked a candidate who is a councillor in Camden, I think.
Okay.
So it'll be interesting if, as well, the Lib Dems are like, okay, we'll hold back here if you've got a really good guy.
Yeah.
You know, they might do some conversations there. But also, by-elections are always dramatic, especially in something like this.
Yeah.
What's worth noting is a suspension of more than 10 days has been very rare.
Okay. Yes, that's
very
true. But
this is very rare circumstances.
Yeah, so already having a defence dossier and then going to the Privileges Committee, that being a televised hearing, all of this is already quite unprecedented. So if anything's going to warrant the first ever 10-day suspension, it's this. But equally, it might also, we don't know. And it would also be very hard for that, like you said, to pass through all the stages that it needs to, especially when the actual committee has a Tory majority as well.
Yeah.
There's a lot for it to get through, but that will be something really interesting that we can follow in the next few weeks. Concerning the next few weeks, we are actually both going on to study leave in a couple of weeks' time. So we don't actually know when the next episode of this podcast will be.
No, we don't.
We don't know.
We'll have to have a think.
Yeah, we'll have to have a think.
We'll have to link up.
Yeah, maybe like over summer we could do some special episodes. That would be nice.
God, imagine what's happening this summer.
Yes, like, I know.
It seems so far away. Mm. Politics just... Too much happens.
Too much happens in between, in like, the gaps.
Because we were meant to do it last week, but I was ill. And then since that, there's just been too much.
So much has happened.
But I think, you know, we enjoy it. We hope you guys like it too.
Yeah. And if we don't do any episodes in summer, we will see you in September.
Yes.
Yes.
But for now, as always, never a quiet week in politics. Thank you for listening to
What's News?